Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part 4 of Wrath, and the last episode covering Jane Whaley and Word of Faith Fellowship. It's been a wild ride, and I'm wrapping this case up on a very emotional note. To be honest, I sobbed, like ugly cry sobbed for the Cooper family, that even in the aftermath of absolute brainwashing and even destroying each other to please Jane Whaley found a way to forgive and grow and come together. But before we get to the heartwarming stuff, we're going to have to get through some more tragedy. But I promise I'll leave you on a positive note. Jane Whaley's greed and control truly knows no bounds. And Jamie Anderson was about to see this firsthand. Jamie's mother was a devoted Word of Faith Fellowship member. And while Jamie resented her for dragging him into the hellhole of Word of Faith, one, he would eventually escape and find himself disowned by his family, his mother was still his mother, and he hated to see her suffer. His stepfather and the love of his mother's life was dying of a rare disease that was attacking his body's organs. When he passed away, the tall, bulky man was barely 100 pounds. And then, after his death, that day, while his mother was grieving, Jamie watched Jane Whaley remove his mother's wedding ring from her finger, saying, "You won't need this anymore." Jamie's mom was heartbroken. They hadn't even buried her husband yet. How could Jane not possibly control herself, even if not to look like an absolute monster? Jamie couldn't contain himself. For the first time, not fearing Jane Whaley's wrath, he charged at her, and he told her what she was doing was disgusting, and she needed to give that ring back. And to his surprise, she did. But likely only because Jane knew she wouldn't be able to charm her way out of that flagrant display of cruelty. Jane Whaley truly has no chill. And she was about to find more members were slipping from her grips. John and Jessica were adjusting to life on the outside. And as days passed after their escape, they were continually reminded of how much they didn't know about the outside world. There was so much they had missed and so much daily distraction of church services, work projects, and more importantly, terrifying punishments for their basic existence that their newfound freedom felt bizarre but exhilarating. They looked the part of a young couple, but carried the weight of hoping that others on the outside wouldn't notice that they didn't pick up on TV show or movie references or pop culture, making it glaringly clear they had grown up in a cult. John was able to fully throw himself into his medical school studies, though, and he was excelling. His only free time was spent being a caring husband to Jessica, doing his best to help her adjust. She was being constantly pressured by her parents to return to the church, and John knew she was vulnerable. Meanwhile, back at Word of Faith Fellowship, it was time for Rick and Suzanne Cooper to make up their minds. They'd tried to leave Word of Faith unsuccessfully years ago and were sucked right back in. John made it clear to his parents that his mind was made up, especially upon learning that Jessica was pregnant. He would never step foot on that compound again. He wouldn't raise his child behind the abusive walls of Word of Faith Fellowship. John Cooper's bravery spread like wildfire within the Cooper family, as not long after his escape, three more Cooper children had left the church. First, Benjamin, who went on to graduate law school, have a baby with his wife, and start a successful recycling business. Then it was Peter's turn to leave. He tried and tried again to get his wife to come with him, but when Amy refused to leave, he had to make a choice. He left and applied to medical school, and shortly after, he was served divorce papers by Amy. Then, Jeffrey and his family followed shortly after. Jeffrey had always been the class pet. Jane always had shown him favoritism. But Jeffrey warned Jane the abuse had to stop or he would leave. Though she promised him it would, it didn't. Not only did she not keep her word, but she attempted to try to change history itself. She insisted to other church members that past abusive events resulting in injury hadn't actually happened, even going so far as to scream at one church leader when in a meeting with lawyers regarding the abuse of Matthew Fenner, the leader demonstrated his part in the abusive actions. But Jane immediately started screaming, "No, no, 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 you did not do that. Your hand was not on his head. That is witchcraft." The participant quickly changed his story. Jeffrey was fed up with Jane's fabrication of the truth. While she spewed lies from the pulpit, he walked out of a sermon with his wife. Jane was denying the abuse ever happened. Unbelievable, Jeffrey thought. His attention soon turned to his parents. How could he make them see the truth? Jeffrey sat down with his parents and explained why he left. It wasn't easy to change the minds of Rick and Suzanne. They were hardcore true believers in Word of Faith's message and had been for two decades. The only thing that might work, Jeffrey mused, was coming at it from a legal perspective. He explained the crimes he had witnessed, the obstruction of justice and felony fraud. The church's actions were criminal, he explained. Jane abuses children. No one can argue that. She destroys families. Was the church really channeling a loving God? And who benefits from this? Certainly not its members. Suzanne and Rick's eyes began to open. How could they have been so blind? Jeffrey made his case. His points were crystal clear. He didn't necessarily expect his parents to leave, but he wanted to plant the seeds of doubt. And over time, Rick and Suzanne began to re-question their beliefs because, as you'll remember, they tried to leave before but were sucked back in. Suzanne eventually admitted to Rick that Jane had pressured her to lie under oath in court about her sister Shanna abusing her children. Shanna hadn't laid a hand on her kids, yet they were taken from her and manipulated into thinking their mom was of the devil. Eventually, after Patrick, Shanna's son, escaped, he went to find his mother and tell her he knew she didn't do anything to harm them, and he missed her. Patrick realized how much his mother loved him. But Shanna had lost the thing nearest and dearest to her, her children. And without that rock, she spiraled back into drugs, and when Patrick finally tracked her down, she was in a Florida work release facility after being arrested. He was able to have dinner with her in the dining hall there, and they caught up and cried about what had happened to them. Patrick told his mom of the brutal beatings in the lower building and shared with her what he had recorded in writing about his bruises and pain. Shanna sobbed. How could she have led her son into such a nightmare? Like Shanna, Rick and Suzanne couldn't believe that they, two well-intentioned parents, ended up like this. They lived for their children. They were just both sad, vulnerable people looking for a community to belong to. Jane Whaley seemed to be their salvation, and they bought into it. Rick and Suzanne were finally realizing, though, it was nothing but lies. They just needed to find the strength to leave. The parents had joined Word of Faith to give their children a better life. And now the children were returning the favor, leading Rick and Suzanne back to freedom. Of their eight children, the three eldest boys had already escaped the clutches of the cult. Chad and Lena would likely stay behind, but the youngest three would leave with their parents. For Rick, the revelations were almost too much to take. Word of Faith had made a mockery of his relationship with God. And not only that, it had ruined his relationship with his family. Word of Faith had ruined his life. He had placed all his faith in the church. He never even complained or protested and had endured every form of abuse that was thrown at him. But he blamed himself for that abuse. Now, though, Rick felt empowered to take his life back. So he set up a meeting with the heads of the church, Jane Whaley included. He wanted them all to hear the truth. "It ends now," Rick said to Suzanne. She agreed. Rick and Suzanne entered that meeting with Jane and her cronies with their heads held high. Rick confronted Jane about the lies his wife was forced to tell to take Shanna's children away from her. He heard his old voice again, confident and strong. His mind was clear of Jane Whaley and her teachings. "What you've done is extremely wrong, illegal, and immoral," Rick said. "You like to talk about things being wicked? That's wicked," Rick said. "You caused my wife to perjure herself. So if it ever comes back, who's going to take the fall?" Whaley was stone-faced. "Suzanne will, of course," she said. I can only imagine the self-control it would have taken to not slap the smug look off Whaley's face. I mean, she had no trouble physically abusing people and getting away with it. She was once taken to court for slamming a girl's head against a wall, but waltzed away scot-free, only paying a fine funded by the tithe of the people she was abusing. In that moment, Rick realized he was no longer afraid of Jane Whaley. He was no longer afraid of retaliation. Rick and Suzanne were not going to put up with it anymore. They'd seen the truth. They were done. They walked out of that office, never to set foot on that evil compound again. /sinners. It's easy to think that everything is magical and perfect on the outside, but the transition proved to be very difficult for most escapees. Rick tried to maintain his Christian beliefs on the outside, visiting churches in the area and encouraging his kids to go with him. And unsurprisingly, though, Rick and Suzanne's relationship didn't dramatically improve on the outside. They had their own grief and struggle to deal with, and a new world to try to understand. They got a TV, but often felt shame for watching it. They joined other family members on a vacation, but Suzanne was too modest to bare her skin on the beach. They were free, but Jane's grip hadn't completely loosened. This was exacerbated by the constant surveillance church members kept on them. They avoided their front yard because former friends and still loyal members of the church lived across the street and would take photos and videos of them to deliver to Jane. And Rick and Suzanne weren't the only escapees to struggle on the outside. John Cooper was taking a psychiatry course along with his regular medical studies at Chapel Hill. When the course focused on the subject of domestic abuse, John was flooded with a string of memories about the church. He was taught about how abusive people isolate their victims and use manipulation to control them. Unable to stay silent, John sought advice from his professors. He met with three different instructors who all told him the same thing. He was morally obligated to report Jane Whaley in Word of Faith Fellowship. He told the teachers, though, that the authorities will be no help. People have tried in the past to get help, but the authorities are too intertwined with the church, and they protect Jane. The professors didn't back down. John had the moral and legal obligation to report the abuse, especially as a future doctor who will encounter situations like this when practicing. So John made the call. He told Rutherford County DSS what he had witnessed and experienced. An escalating abuse of children and babies by Jane and church leaders. The agency claimed they were going to investigate, but soon after, they dropped the case. So, John got the idea to call an investigative reporter, Mitch Weiss, which is what sparked the book, Broken Faith, where much of this research came from, about the very recent but still strangely unknown cult of Jane Whaley. As Mitch was gathering more and more stories of abuse from former members, he took his case to his editors, who agreed this story needs to be told on a larger scale. They then added another investigative journalist, Holbrook Moore, to the story, and together, they set out to find the truth. They interviewed about 100 former members and found eerily similar stories. The abuse, mind control, and isolation had severely damaged their lives. Many had PTSD, flashbacks, and nightmares. Many suffered ongoing depression, and some were addicted to drugs or alcohol to help them cope. They struggled with their faith. John Blanton said he no longer believes in God. He says he has found a new use for pages in the Bible. Quote, I use them to roll joints. Most of the survivors that left the cult are never fully able to leave their trauma behind. Relationships are hard. Many marriages fail due to trying to make up for lost time on the outside after being so sexually suppressed for decades. This usually proves to be unhealthy for them as they aren't equipped to cope with the shame or guilt they feel after. Some former members are now homeless. Some are sucked into or exploited in corrupt situations. And most are incredibly lonely. After years of being monitored and living communally, the deafening sound of a lonely apartment is excruciating. AP and the journalists also exposed the forced labor of young Brazilians that Jane had brought up to North Carolina to force into virtual slavery. Escapees have been banned from attending funerals of loved ones who died within the church. Some have even taken their own lives. Matthew Fenner had taken the church to court to criminally pay for his abuse. It was a long process that brought about his greatest tragedy to date. Less than 2 weeks after his trial was deemed a mistrial by the judge, Matthew's grandfather, Robert Rape, the man he idolized and who helped him escape, was found dead in his yard from a shotgun blast to the chest. Matthew was destroyed. Authorities said his grandfather committed suicide, but the manner of death left many people wondering if he had been killed. Another unsettling death surrounding an advocate for the victims of Jane Whaley. And Michael Lowry might be the most heartbreaking of all. His life has spiraled out of control. After the church essentially kidnapped him back in and forced him to recant any allegations against them, they then tried to arrange him into a marriage with one of the Brazilian women they had forced into labor in the name of God. He wouldn't do it, and he escaped again. He moved in with an aunt in Michigan, and according to his aunt, when he moved out on his own, he fell in with a group of bad people in Detroit. And now, Michael lives in a group home. In interviews conducted by Mitch and Holbrook, they reported that Michael said, quote, I don't have much hope. I need help, I know, but where am I going to get it? His aunt said all the years of abuse inside the church have taken a toll. She worries for Michael's safety. At times, he roams the streets. When he closes his eyes, he said, it all comes back to him. The nightmares, the brutality. He still doesn't know if he's gay. That doesn't matter anyway, though, he said. I don't think I'll ever escape. Predicting that, quote, I'm going to end up dead. I know it. Maybe that's the only way it will ever stop.
Okay.
I am absolutely...
Try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait. Will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
What? Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again?
Fruit ruins
Never
insulin
eat after 7 p.m.
One cheat day.
Cut carbs by
30 days. Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. That's Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Shipping. Infuriatingly, Jane Whaley and Word of Faith Fellowship leaders are still going strong, destroying lives and sleeping like babies in their North Carolina mansions. Jane even had plans to build a lavish new sanctuary. And how is she to pay for it? Well, with one of the most expensive emeralds in the world. And how was she to obtain this emerald? Well, she may or may not have stolen it. In Broken Faith, they lay out the heist like this. It began in 2014, when a member of the Brazilian church, a gem dealer, asked his minister to watch the rock for him while he was in the hospital. It was worth millions, he said. When the man was released, his rock was gone. The preacher wouldn't say where it was. The gem dealer's daughter, Rebecca Mella, was a teacher at the Word of Faith Fellowship School in Spindale. Her dad told her his stone was missing, so she confronted Jane Whaley. Jane told her she and all the Brazilian pastors knew where the rock was, but that it wasn't worth much. The security team escorted Mello off church grounds. What they didn't know was that Mello had recorded the conversation. The investigative team drilled down and found more details and documents regarding the rock. The rock was in the custody of Freightworks, a trucking company owned by Josh Farmer and his father, Ray. It was stored in a North Carolina warehouse. Two companies that specialize in precious stones analyzed the rock or parts of it. One of them, EGL USA, noted that it was the largest emerald-encrusted stone of its kind the group had ever seen. It's unclear how the rock got to the United States, but once there, Mark Morris, whom we've heard from in other episodes and some of those clips, and other church leaders went to a gem show in Arizona to meet Dwayne Hall, a reality TV character known as the gem hunter on the show Prospectors. Hall said Josh Farmer asked him to clean the gem and prepare it. Farmer said he was a preacher who wanted to use the proceeds to build a church and school in a poor village in Brazil. Farmer, Morris, and other church leaders prayed with Hall, and Hall decided to do the job. In early 2016, Hall said that Farmer had come for the rock. He took it, and Hall was never paid. He said he worked more than a year on the rock because he thought it was for a charitable cause. He had no idea that Farmer was not a preacher. And after it left his house, that's where the trail goes cold. No one, except the church, knows what happened to the emerald-studded stone. The reporters discovered that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is looking into the alleged theft on behalf of the Brazilian government. Brazil is one of the most resource-rich nations in the world, and a gem like this is considered national patrimony. What does the future hold for Jane Whaley and Word of Faith Fellowship? In perhaps the most scariest of all endings, some speculate that Jane Whaley might be capable of the ultimate evil. Remember how I've dropped the word cyanide a few times on this case? Well, this is where it comes from. Josh Farmer, current member, who is quoted on the Word of Faith Fellowship website defending Jane and the church, said this, quote, "Our church has been the target of religious bigotry and persecution for several decades. One-sided media stories with salacious headlines established the narrative and attempted to hang on us the cult label. Inevitably, investigations by several government agencies followed. Despite the adversity, our church, its leaders, and its members have been vindicated at every point." Okay. Clearly a devout Word of Faith Fellowship member, Josh Farmer is also, like I mentioned, that local business owner of the trucking company, and in 2017 announced some exciting news for the company. In a press release, he said his company is now certified under the International Cyanide Management Code to transport sodium cyanide, a deadly poisonous chemical. What would you need to transport cyanide for? Some former members find that troubling. If authorities take action to shut down the church, will they arrest more members? And if they do, will it be peaceful? No one wants another Jonestown, where over 900 cult members drank a cyanide-laced drink when faced with an end to their church. Who knows? It's a large and very dangerous speculation, but former members know what Jane is capable of, so it's not out of the realm of possibility. Okay, but I refuse to leave you on that ominous note. We deserve to walk away from this with a bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling. It is the holiday season, after all. A holiday season that Suzanne and Rick Cooper used to go all out on before they entered the church. Suzanne had even collected ornaments from each new place they traveled during military assignments. These were all gone now, though, as they were forced to sell their worldly possessions upon joining the church. Items sold at church yard sales, with the proceeds going to Jane Whaley. Their older children had vague memories of the holidays, but their younger children had never celebrated a Christmas, a birthday, nothing. The first Christmas after leaving Word of Faith Fellowship was going to be special, though. Adam, their youngest, was already learning classic Christmas songs, and he was teaching himself to play them on the piano. O Holy Night moved from his fingers onto the keys. He was focusing on this song in particular as he had found out that it was his grandmother's favorite. And being that it was going to be the first time she had visited, he wanted to surprise her. Suzanne was filled with joy watching her son practice and decided it was time to kick up the Christmas spirit notch a little further. So she told Adam it was time to go Christmas shopping. She was going to go big, and she would replace the ornaments and the joy Jane had stolen from her, and she wanted Adam with her every step of the way. His first Christmas was going to be grand. It was 11:30 p.m. when Suzanne announced the shopping trip, and Adam, giddy and with joy, said, "I want to go with you. I've never had a Christmas tree." "Well, you're going to have one this year," Suzanne said. They blasted Christmas carols through the car speakers as they drove to the late-night store. While in the church, the kids had been told by church leaders to shield their eyes when driving around town during Christmas, not to notice the holiday decor on the homes. Adam was overwhelmed with delight when looking around the store at the various Christmas displays. He was 18 years old but had the excitement of a little boy. Suzanne had never seen her son so thrilled, and she was instantly struck by an overwhelming thought. She knew what Word of Faith Fellowship had done to her and her family. They had brainwashed them into not feeling, not caring about life, about anything. The blasting killed the fight in them. The isolation sucked companionship out of them. And the constant shame stole all joy. Everything about Jane Whaley and her tactics were meant to keep her followers down, make them pawns for her control. And even though they didn't have much money, Suzanne and Adam were determined to reverse this. They piled their cart high with Christmas decor. A local noticed their overwhelming happiness and realized she recognized Suzanne, then blurted out, "Did y'all leave Word of Faith?" "Yeah," Adam said, beaming. "This is Adam's first time celebrating Christmas," Suzanne said. "Well, praise the Lord. I'm happy for you too. I hope you have a great Christmas," the woman said. "We surely will," Suzanne replied. The woman smiled with joy for them before walking away. "We need to put something on top of the tree," Suzanne said. "What goes up there?" Adam asked. "Well, it could be a star or an angel," Suzanne said. "Let's get an angel. That would drive Jane crazy," Adam said. Feeling like an absolute rebel, he chose a golden angel, and Suzanne agreed that it was perfect. "If Jane saw this, we'd be dealt with, you know?" "Well, we don't have to worry about her now," Suzanne said. Then they set out to get the biggest Christmas tree in the store, and they did. But there was one last decoration the home needed. Suzanne felt horrible about how she had shut her sweet mother out of their lives. The children were going to have to re-get to know or even get to know her for the first time and form a new relationship with their grandmother. Suzanne had cut her mother out of their lives with every scream and slam of the phone. Her mother wasn't there for the birth of many of her children. Family dinners and grandma babysitting were non-existent when they entered the church. And Suzanne was determined to make up for lost time. She couldn't take back the past, but when she was reminded of a song she loved from her youth, she knew where to start. Okay, so I'm a sucker for a Vietnam-era war song. Gets me every time. So perhaps this is why this made me cry like a baby, or just because it's a beautiful message for the Cooper family's healing. "Tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree." The song was written around the time of Vietnam, but its idea originated from this true story. The songwriter, L. Russell Brown, was reading a Reader's Digest article one day. It was about a soldier coming home from Andersonville prison in the Civil War, and he was going to Pennsylvania. He told his girl in a letter, quote, "I'll understand if I should stay on the stagecoach, but if I shouldn't, tie a big yellow handkerchief on the big oak tree outside of town, and then I'll know if it's there, I should get off. But I'll understand that you found someone else in the last 3 years." He couldn't bear to look at it himself, though, so he told the other people in the stagecoach and the driver to please look. When they got to the big oak tree, everybody yelled and screamed. He looked out the window and it was covered with yellow handkerchiefs. That story has always given me chills, and clearly it did for Suzanne, too. She had shut her mom out so many times in the past, and in a way, she herself had just left a virtual prison, so she hummed the song in her head as she picked up a spool of yellow ribbon and dropped it in the shopping cart. Suzanne realized a handful of yellow ribbons wouldn't be enough, though, so she grabbed another bundle. Mama deserves more, she thought. She deserves 100 yellow ribbons and a big yellow banner. Back at home, Suzanne and Adam stayed up all night decorating. And finally, around 5 a.m., they were ready for the big reveal. Adam plugged in the lights from the Christmas tree, and the tree glowed. It was beautiful. Wanda had been on the road for 9 hours, driving straight through from Florida. She could have stopped to rest, but she didn't. Fueled by the loss of time and the anticipation to make up for it, she powered through. She wasn't going to waste a single second. Her family was so blessed to be back together. Excitement filled her soul as she turned on the Cooper's Road to their house, and then she saw a big yellow banner on the house. "Welcome home, Mom," the sign read. Then she saw all the ribbons tied to all the trees. Her heart almost burst. She knew exactly what the yellow ribbons meant. She was home. She parked the car and just started sobbing tears of joy. Then the front door burst open and everyone ran outside to give her a welcome worthy of a war hero. She could hear them calling her name as they ran, Mama Gail, as she was affectionately referred to, Mama Gail. They opened up the car door, grabbed her suitcase, hugged and kissed her. She was meeting some of her grandchildren for the first time, and everyone else would be arriving soon for a beautiful dinner. The family would celebrate in a big way. The dining table was flush with holiday food. Turkey, black-eyed peas, butter beans, pies, and cakes. And they also made Mama Gail's famous sweet potato balls. Yams mixed with pineapple and then rolled in shredded coconut and topped with a cherry. And everyone was moving at their own pace at assimilating back into a normal life outside the cult. Some, like Adam, had no problem belting out the top hits of the day, and while he helped set up, he started singing Bruno Mars' new hit, Uptown Funk, and he was singing loud. I'm too hot, hot damn, call the police and a fireman. Rick's mother, Cora, who had just left the church a few weeks after the Coopers, gasped, though, unsure of how to handle her grandson singing ungodly music, but he kept on. He was free, and so was she. She would realize in time that she could do whatever she wanted. Maybe she'd even start playing the sweepstakes again. Then John and Jessica pulled up and Wanda threw her arms around her grandson and his pregnant wife and just smiled. They feasted and laughed, but among all the joyful chaos, Wanda noticed her daughter starting to tear up. Not wanting her family to see her cry, however, Suzanne stepped outside. So Wanda followed and she put her arms around her daughter. I can't believe I let this happen, Suzanne said. Suzanne, it's okay, Wanda said, wrapping her arms around her. We're together now. That's the important thing and we're gonna get through this. Sometimes I can't stand myself for what I've done, Suzanne said, recounting what she had done to betray her sister Shanna. She then told Wanda of her fears for her sister and her children and Shanna's children who were still in the cult. Suzanne, they will come back to us, Wanda said, just like you came back to me. We don't know what tomorrow will bring, Wanda said. Suzanne cried, unable to reckon with the feeling of being human, feeling emotion again. She confided in her mom that the church teaches you to not care or feel for yourself or others, and that allowing these emotions in was new and painful. As Wanda hugged her, they heard the sweet sounds of Adam playing O Holy Night on the piano, and the entire family were singing together. They were free, and they were a family again. A family so close that even Jane Whaley's wrath couldn't tear them apart. When Suzanne and Shanna were finally reunited, their bond of family was never more clear. Their fractured family could survive anything. In the middle of their first embrace, Suzanne whispered, I'm sorry. She didn't have to say anything else. We're family. In the end, that's what matters, Shanna said. This concludes the four parts on Jane Whaley and the Word of Faith Fellowship. I can only hope that the Cooper family are just the beginning of families breaking free of Jane Whaley's control. Thank you so much for listening. It means so much to us. And if you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do is to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. And leave a 5-star rating and positive review. It helps so much. And connect with us on Instagram at 7deadlysinnerspodcast. We absolutely love hearing from you, love hearing your stories, and still blown away by how many connections there are to these crazy cases. And the next case is likely the grossest one we've covered so far, so let's close our eyes, bow our heads, and buckle up for season 2 continuing on. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.